First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
Nearly half this city's renters can't really afford their apartments. Good morning. We're live with you from Studio 2. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead this hour, what are the solutions for the rental housing crisis in Jacksonville? We'll take a closer look in just a moment, and you can join us, 549-2937. Then later, it's been billed a gathering of the world's elites, but one local businessman flew to Davos, Switzerland, and took part in the World Economic Forum. We'll hear his experience, that and more all ahead this morning. But first this hour, a new report is out this week looking at the state of the rental housing crisis in Jacksonville. And it finds that nearly half the city's renters are cost burdened. In other words, they're paying more than 30% of their monthly income on rent. That's not how it's supposed to work. So what are we going to do about this? Well, UNF Professor David Jaffe is director of the Jacks Rental Housing Project, and he's on the line. Dr. Jaffe, good morning.
Good morning.
And here's our question to callers right now. What do you pay in rent every month? Can you afford your rent? Do you have a bunch of roommates, maybe, just to be able to make the rent? Let's hear your rent stories. Give us a call, 549-2937. Emails to First Coast Connect at wjct.org. Tweets to at Melissa Injax. So, David Jaffe, your Jack's Rental Housing Project is out with a new report on the city's housing crisis and some solutions. We'll get to those in a bit. But first, as I read through this, it's pretty eye-popping when you learn that nearly half the city's renters are shelling out up to as much as half their monthly paycheck on rent. That's not how it's supposed to work. Tell us what your report found.
The report includes some of those statistics in the first section, so people get a sense of what the state of rental housing is in Jacksonville. You mentioned that about 50% of renters in Jacksonville are cost burdened, which means they're spending more than 30% of their income on rent. I think it's important to point out that that statistic, although it's the best available statistic at the moment, it's from 2019. So the largest spike in rent rates have happened since 2019, which means that the 47.4, which you say 50%, is grossly underestimated. So everyone needs to know that. And for renters and tenants out there, they probably understand that as well. We also report what is called severely cost burdened. And in Jacksonville, again, in 2019, and this is an underestimate, it's 23.2%. That means that they're spending more than 50% of their income just on rent.
Just on rent. Now, not only that, David, the rent has really spiked in the last few years. The average renter in Duval County saw somewhere between $300 to $500 a month increase in their monthly rent payment over the last few years. And people just can't, they just can't afford those kind of huge spikes. What's driving those increases?
Okay, well, that's a large part of what this report is. And I would like to make one distinction between a report I was involved in earlier with the city council. I don't know if you had somebody on the show talking about that. It was a critical quality life issues committee.
Yes.
Which looked at, okay, so you've already covered that. So I was involved in that, and I contributed quite a bit to the final report in terms of the recommendations. So I definitely would encourage people to look at that, because there are 10 recommendations. There's no single way to address the problem. What I've been looking at in this more recent report, once I got back to my research project, was one of the most significant factors that was not sufficiently addressed or discussed during those proceedings with the city council, but which I think is probably one of the most important to understand. And that is what I call the financialization of human shelter. And what that means is that increasingly, private investment firms, private equity firms are buying up hundreds and thousands of homes. They're bundling these into investment vehicles for their wealthy clients. Seen a sharp rise in the purchasing of single-family homes in Jacksonville by the institutional investors. And they're not only buying single-family homes, they're also buying multifamily apartment complexes. And again, what's important to understand is that they are purchasing these as investment vehicles for their investors, their wealthy clients around the world, and they expect a return on their investment. And therefore, a large part of this increase is related to the fact that there are shareholders who are expecting some kind of return on their investment in the properties in Jacksonville. So we have renters, tenants in Jacksonville struggling to pay rent. And at the other end, you have investors that are reaping the benefits of this sharp spike in rent in Jacksonville. And not just in Jacksonville. This is a national problem, but much more significant in the Southeast, in the major metropolitan areas, and all of the major metropolitan areas in Florida.
Yeah, as you report, Jacksonville is consistently cited as one of the top metro areas in the nation for investor acquisition of homes or apartments. And of course, human shelter is a basic human need, but as you write, it's become an asset class product marketed to wealthy investors. So in other words, people are now at the mercy of investors seeking a higher return when they just are trying to rent a home or an apartment. And I've told this story before, David. There was a homeowner over on the West Side who has the same name as me. I won't give the address, but for over 2 years now, almost every week, I get a text message from some institutional investor begging me to sell them my home. I don't own this home. They mistakenly think I own this home. It's a small, I looked it up. It's a small two-bedroom bungalow on a neighborhood on the near west side. And I am constantly being bombarded with text messages from people who think I own this property and they want to buy it from me. Institutional investors who can then turn it around and rent it out to someone who's desperate for a place to live and is willing to pay a ridiculously high rent. You know, it's incredible how aggressive these investors are in trying to acquire all of these properties in this city, and how it's distorting the market and how it's making it harder for people to find an affordable place to live.
Right. And the other impact of that is on the, you know, the first time home buyer that's looking for a home, they go to a realtor and they start looking at homes and they find one they like. And they're consistently outbidded by the institutional investors that obviously can offer cash and often waive inspections and other things which make it attractive to the seller. And so the market for single family homes is getting contracted by virtue of all of these homes being purchased and converted into rental
properties. So what I hear you saying then is not only is the rent unaffordable, the traditional ladder to the American dream, the middle class, you know, a young couple or whoever wanting to buy that starter home, that's out of reach now too for many.
That's right. That's right. And they're competing with institutional investors. And I've talked to many people and I've talked to realtors who tell me it gets very frustrating. And interestingly enough, they end up renting a home from the very institutional investor that they probably lost the competition to in a home that they wanted to buy.
If you had to think of an adjective to describe that, what would it be?
unrestrained, predatory financialization.
Predatory.
Yes.
Okay, folks, we're getting lots of your tweets about this, and we want your calls, too. What are you paying every month for rent? Are you having trouble making your rent? We're talking with UNF's David Jaffe of the Jack's Rental Housing Project. Their new report is out. It's 549-2937. Give us a call. Here's Rebecca on Twitter. I was priced out of Jacksonville entirely. In May, my rent went up $280 a month. I was on a fixed income, and that was unaffordable. I moved to Louisville, Kentucky, where my family lives and where rent is much less expensive. My story was featured in the Times Union. She says, Phoenix tweets us $1,550 a month for a 764-square-foot one bed, one bath apartment, and it's too expensive to move. Something has to give soon. Here's another tweet. I'm cost burdened to leasing companies, and they find this unacceptable. They've sent 4 different contractors to put a Band-Aid weather strip on a door and a frame that should be completely replaced. I feel like I'm taken advantage of, he says, and he's got a picture of the problem in his home. Here's one more tweet. It's a national problem, but local government can be effective in trying to help with sensible laws and regulations to combat speculators and Airbnb. We didn't even mention Airbnb and Vrbo and companies right. like that, David, but that's a factor yeah. as well, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes, it is. It's not a significant factor, but and that varies by area, neighborhood. But yes, that's another factor that is limiting the availability of housing.
One more tweet. We simply need new models of ownership and financing that work for regular people, co-ops and community trusts. The so-called market has no solutions that work, even for 2-income families making well above minimum wage. And so as we talk about this, we're going to go to some calls now at 549-2937. Let us know your rent story, or if you're a homeowner, we want to hear from you too. Kimberly in Springfield. Hi, Kimberly. Go ahead.
Hey, Melissa. I think what I'm seeing as a realtor in Northeast Florida is sellers are becoming more aware of these investors, and I'm hearing from sellers time after time that they do not want to entertain an offer from an investment company. And, you know, I think the real estate community is also educating our sellers about these investors and, you know, how to deal with offers from them.
Oh, 100%, Kimberly. You know, thank you for that. David, I started punking the institutional investors that were incessantly texting me all the time about this property they mistakenly thought I owned. I'd get all these text messages. We really want to buy your home and such a place. And I'd write back, yes, the negotiations start at $800,000. And then they'd
respond.
And then they'd, and I won't entertain anything below that. And then they'd text me back, well, that's actually a little more than we had hoped to offer you. Can we negotiate?
Right.
But the truth is that we do own a home. It's not at this other place. But if we ever were to sell it, we would definitely not sell it to an institutional investor. And I think people are starting to realize that they are making things more difficult for the average renter or homeowner.
Yeah, I think consciousness is being raised, and I'm glad to hear that the realtors are communicating with their clients about this as well. I think it's a positive step. You have a lot of individuals who, you know, sort of make a living out of searching for properties that they can make an offer on. These are the kinds of text messages you get. I get them as well. And then once they find them, because we did interview somebody who was involved in this process, it was just basically kind of a free agent person. But once they are able to establish sort of a preliminary contract, then they get in touch with the larger investment firms, and the larger investment firms then step in and they give those individuals a commission for locating that property. So the process is quite interesting in how it ultimately ends up in the hands of the institutional investors and then, of course, converted to a rental property and bundled again into an asset class investment.
Here's an email from Kate in the Rail Yard District. A company bought the property next to me for only $7,000, including the land and the house. They bulldozed it to the ground and hauled it all away to a landfill. The irony is the architectural salvage company Eco Relics was just a half a mile away. And when this small 3-bedroom house is rented, it'll probably go for close to $2,000 a month because it's a brand new dwelling. All right, let's go to John in Riverside. Go ahead, John.
What I wanted to say was we need to tax the wealthy. This is what you get when you let all the money go to the top 1%, top 1.1%. What's going to happen to us is it's going to be similar to used to be in ghettos, where when the investor class knew that the people in the ghetto couldn't move anyplace else, they raised their rents and didn't take care of the structures. Mm. We're seeing that now. The problem is they've taken money away from the middle class, so you can't start making widgets or some other business because the middle class doesn't have any money to buy extra things, but they have to have housing.
Yeah.
So they're going to squeeze us this way. You have to take the money away from the top 1%, or they're going to turn into the aristocracy, and we're all going to be peasants on their estates.
Thank you, John. Now, David Jaffe, you do have some specific policy proposals in your report that could even the playing field a little bit for all of the tenants out there. We'll go into that in more detail in a minute, but you do have some ideas you'd like our local officials to look at, right?
Yes. So there are a few recommendations. They were made in the Critical Quality Life Issue report as well. They're fairly standard, but they do require city government and the city council to actually take action. And, you know, there's some skepticism about the ability of that body to take the action that's needed. So some fairly standard ways that municipalities, cities, communities have tried to deal with this is through inclusionary forms of housing and inclusionary forms of zoning. Inclusionary forms of housing would be either a requirement or incentive that apartment, multifamily apartment complexes include a certain percentage of units that are below what's called the fair market rent. So that's commonly done. It's currently being done in some areas in Jacksonville. That could be expanded. Something that will be much more difficult to implement is inclusionary zoning, and that is where you take residential areas currently in Jacksonville, presumably, 90% of residential properties are exclusively zoned for single-family homes. That's 90%. So you could reform the zoning laws and allow for the building of something other than single-family homes, maybe duplex, triplex, multiplex, small apartment complexes in these communities, in these neighborhoods. That's something called the missing middle strategy. Now, of course, you're going to run up against NIMBYism, which is not in my backyard. And so, you know, politically, I'm sure city council members are somewhat reluctant to propose this for their constituents.
But you have other solutions, too, including, for example, a tenant's bill of rights for the city, which other cities have looked at doing, giving tenants more rights.
Yes, exactly. So the two leading policy proposals in my report, because I'm really focusing on the balance of power much more than in the city council report. So the first is there has to be some way, and I think some of the callers have mentioned this, there has to be some way to monitor and regulate institutional investors and the patterns of concentrated ownership. This also will require, if you're interested in doing this, greater transparency. In the report, I described the fact that if you go into the property appraiser database and you're looking up properties and you want to know who owns them, it has some cryptic, esoteric LLC name that in no way allows you to figure out who ultimately owns the property. Mm-hmm. So then you have to go off into a kind of internet sleuthing process to locate. That's something we've been doing on the project. It takes a lot of time, but we need to monitor and regulate institutional investors. Now, one of the things we need to know is in the state of Florida, there are preemption laws at the state level that essentially prohibit localities from taking any kind of action that might in any way encroach on the prerogative of, investment firms or private owners. And already there is a bill that's been proposed for the Senate. They haven't even gone into session yet, which will be preempting any form of rent control whatsoever. It was pretty much prohibited generally, but there was one loophole. So when we think about these, we also need to think about at the state level what they're doing to actually prevent cities and localities from implementing these policies. But that's one. So at the upper end, where you want to regulate the most powerful, you need to do that. And maybe there should be a limit on the percentage of properties owned by a single institutional investor. The other is to expand the rights and protections for tenants. And this can be done with the Tenants' Bill of Rights. This was a recommendation in the City Council report. It's a recommendation in mine. A Tenants' Bill of Rights has been passed in Miami, Pinellas, Orange County. It's now time for Jacksonville to do the same.
All right.
This would be incredibly helpful to tenants first of all, knowing their rights and then being able to exercise them in a relationship to landlords. And one of the reasons Florida has been such a attractive place for the institutional investors is because it is so easy to institute all kinds of requirements and fees on tenants, and the tenants have very little ability to organize against that.
And we're hearing from tenants. We also have a property owner on the line, Meetan in Jacks Beach. Meetan, hello. Go ahead.
Hi. Hi. I'm hearing all this, and maybe the other side of it is for the landlords. So the increase, I'm a landlord, and the increase is really coming from the insurance, increase in insurance, increase in HOA, increase in, payment, the mortgage payment, the interest hike. So all these are affecting landlords. Which
No, you're right. And I'm sure you're feeling the pinch yourself. So I appreciate the call.
Absolutely.
Thank you for the...
I'm forced to increase the rent every renewal, at every annual renewal. And I do it gradually. But hey, there is a cost attached to the landlords.
Yeah. Thank you for that. So what about that, Professor Jaffe?
I'd like to make a distinction because when I talk about financialization, some people say, well, you know, housing has always been financialized. I think there's a distinction between someone who maybe owns five or six rental properties in Jacksonville, and that is a direct source of income to them. And they obviously have the kinds of cost considerations that that caller mentioned. That's entirely different from an institutional investor or a private equity firm that is buying up hundreds and thousands of properties and bundling these together as investment vehicles. So it's very important to make that distinction. What he describes is probably more common for what we call the mom and pop landlords. The institutional investors, the corporate landlords, are entirely different, in an entirely different category. And they're the ones that have been, particularly in the multifamily apartment complexes, jacking up rent when somebody renews their lease year to year, $300, $400, $500.
Mm-hmm. Donna in Mandarin. Hello, Donna. What are your thoughts?
Hello. Pardon me?
Go ahead, Donna.
Yes. I'd just like to start by saying I'm 65 and my husband's 60, and we got ourselves locked in with one of these, they call them Wall Street landlords from the research that I've done, and they, if insurance is such a big deal, then why wouldn't they fix a leaky a door that actually leaks? You've seen the picture. And they keep sending out, well, they're actually yard people to do a contractor repair. And it's just a game. I feel like we're being gamed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Donna, you know, a tenant's bill of rights would give you a little bit of protection, hopefully.
And I have nothing to work with.
I got you, Donna, and I'm so sorry to hear that, and I appreciate the call. Lots of calls, by the way, all over town. Nicholas on the north side. Hi, Nicholas.
Hi, good morning. I'm a homeowner in the north side of Jacksonville. I recently relocated to the Bay Area. Certainly feeling the increased rent prices all over the country. Mm. I have some positive news that I have a single family home that I am seeking to rent out at an affordable price. So if anybody wants to reach out there, it's del.nicolas@outlook.com.
Okay.
It's a 4-bedroom home.
All right. Make a pitch.
3-bathroom.
Yeah.
4-bedroom home, 3 bathrooms in a beautiful suburb on the north side, right next to Publix. Right by the River City Marketplace. So if anybody's out there looking for an affordable home with quite a decent space, about 2,800 square foot, an email. I'd be sure to
Email address one more time.
Yeah, it's going to be del.nicolas.
DEL.NICOLAS. Yeah, you cut out there. You cut out DEL.NICOLAS at outlook.com. Is that right?
DEL.NICOLAS@outlook.com.
All right.
So
thank you.
Nicholas without the H. Thank
Got
you.
It. Okay. So check that out, everyone. And David Jaffe, your report is out. Will you be presenting it to people who might actually have some ability to do something about this? Because the city council has been getting heat for a while from activists and others saying you've got to provide some relief or try something to provide people in the city a little relief.
Right. Everything I do with the project, I distribute broadly across Jacksonville to officials and to city council members. That's probably one reason I was asked to sit on the city council affordable housing committee with Jacoby Pittman as the co-chair. So I distribute this widely. If people are interested in seeing the report, if they just do a search online, JAX, J-A-X, Rental Housing Project, it'll come up. They'll go to our website and it's under reports. So yes, I'm going to continue to apply the pressure. And of course, because the critical quality life issue committees were actually introduced and organized by the city council, I think they have some responsibility to take the recommendations in their own report and begin to move on ways to address the affordable housing issue.
Check it out, the Jax Rental Housing Project, directed by UNF's David Jaffe. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And much more still ahead later. Novelist, poet, and publisher Francis Poole comes to Jacksonville. But up next.
What was ironic is Governor DeSantis, just before I boarded the plane, made some announcement about it's a gathering of these elites. And I thought, wow, I must be one of those elites.
Why one local businessman decided to go to Davos, the World Economic Forum. We'll be right back. Well, it's known as the World Economic Forum, the annual gathering of the world's alleged elites in Davos, Switzerland. But one local businessman, Richard Cuff, decided he was sure elite enough to attend. He attended the forum recently to talk up investing in African-American communities. Here's what happened. Richard Cuff, good to be with you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So why did Richard Cuff, Jacksonville man and community leader, go to Davos, the World Economic Forum?
I was actually invited by my attorney and her law firm, and we were opening an office in D.C., and we were talking about expanding our Nisemba Business Alliance there to D.C. and Atlanta, and she got an invitation to go to Davos to speak and asked if I would come along to participate. And I jumped at the chance.
So tell us about it. What was it like? Because we tend to think of it as this fancy gathering of world elites that's gotten a lot of criticism, frankly, over the years. What was it really like?
It is nothing like that. In fact, what was ironic is this Governor DeSantis, just before I boarded the plane, made some announcement about it's a gathering of these elites. And I thought, wow, I must be one of those elites. But the reality of it is, number one, the country is beautiful. The infrastructure is, and the winding roads through the mountains is breathtaking. But the event itself is, you have to experience it because there are actually two different events. There's what's called the white badge events, and if there's an elite version to it, that's more the state leaders and things like that. But there's a whole bunch of networking that's going on throughout the city of Davos, and that's what we had an opportunity to participate in.
And in particular, you talked about expanding opportunities for African-American investors and business leaders. Is that right?
Yes. The reason why I jumped at the chance, I saw that I've been advocating for small and micro businesses for decades, 30 years that I've been here in Jacksonville. But I saw this as an opportunity to take that voice to the world stage and get these movers and shakers, if you will, on the global level to understand that when we start talking about emerging markets on the global level, we automatically think a woman digging a well in Africa or a small village trying to, you know, create some shops, and it costs around $500 or so. And I said, if we would only look at African Americans as an emerging market, and okay, so it takes $5,000 to $50,000, but the approach that we would take would say, let's tap into that market. It would really change the way that we look at the African American community, because then we would focus not on, as Governor DeSantis is doing with blocking AP studies, African American studies. You'd recognize that it's a $1.6 trillion economy that can really make a major difference if we were to really tap into it. And I think that that voice is being heard. People are beginning to recognize the opportunities that exist within the African-American community as it relates to what's called micro private equity investments.
And you've been doing work on that score right here in Jacksonville yourself. What's the latest on
yes.
that?
Yes. My August 2021, my wife passed away, unfortunately, but we had been privately funding an early childhood music program called Guiding Success. And for right now, we're experiencing great success with students that were kindergartners are now in college because of our work with the violin. But when my wife passed away, yes, my life was shattered, but I just vowed to continue her work. So we're opening the Miriam R. Cuff Innovation Center here on Dunn Avenue. And for the past 10 years or so, I've been advocating renaming this area Blossom Ridge. And so we're in the process of getting it designated as the Blossom Ridge Business District. And
why Blossom Ridge?
Actually, it's the name of the street that comes into my subdivision.
Okay.
And it sounded better than Pine Estates, which was the other street. So Pine Estates sounded too hoity-toity, as my daughter would say. But Blossom Ridge just happened to be a great name. And also the reason for Blossom Ridge was because the North Side had negative connotations that always came back to crime. But if this area was its own separate city, one of the ratings say that this area has a 65% lower crime rate than the average throughout Duval County, 3% lower property costs. It would be a great city to live in if it was a separate city. It's just that we don't talk about this area as if it is. And I want to spend the next couple years really getting the globe, the people around the world to understand that this area is a great place to do business. And now that organizations on a global level are aware of what we're doing here, I think we're going to begin to see more of a global approach or a global attention given to this area.
To this area. And as a result of the relationships you worked on during the trip to Davos, you're unveiling a new leadership alliance later this spring in Jacksonville at the upcoming Think Bold Festival. Tell us about that.
Yes, the Think Bold Festival is going to take place April 14th and 15th, and we're still bringing together leaders from the African-American community. Your listeners may be aware of the guys that you can go to thinkboldfest.com, and you'll see who we're bringing in. But the goal with the Think Bold Festival is, again, to bring bold thinkers who will have great ideas to be able to say how we can move our community forward by bringing in investors from around, you know, money is green, as they say. We're bringing investments into the Black community and bringing thought leaders to the forefront who can make a difference. And we are, our business alliance, Nisemba Business Alliance, we're going to be launching the Nisemba Global Leadership Alliance, and that will be the group that I will make certain that I sponsor and host as we go to Davos year after year going forward.
Richard Cuff, thanks for updating us on all of this, and good to be with you.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the time.
Novelist, poet, and publisher Frances Poole is coming to town next week. It's part of an upcoming bash at FSCJ called The Experience, a big get-together for the local arts and literary community. Writer and historian Tim Gilmore is here to tell us more. Hey, good morning.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having us.
It's always good to see you. So who is Frances Poole?
Frances Poole is a writer. He's a poet and a novelist. Last year, he co-authored a novel with poet Mark Terrell called Ultra Zone, a Tangier ghost story. Mm-hmm. It's set in Tangier, Morocco, during this period of time when there was the Tangier International Zone. So that's where the
famous zone where anything goes.
Yeah. So in this novel, as a matter of fact, the ghosts of William S. Burroughs and Paul Bowles and Brian Jones of the Rolling Stones and a number of other people have these kind of madcap misadventures. Mm-hmm. And there's a word virus that comes from Burroughs's own hidden secret writings. I don't want to give away too much, but that word virus is the antagonist of the novel, I guess you could say.
Now, this appearance by Poole is part of The Experience, which is a big happening at FSCJ's Kent campus. I'm going to be giving a talk there myself. Tell us more about The Experience.
You know, so this I have to give a shout out to my colleague, Jennifer Chase, who is the faculty advisor to The Experience, FSCJ's Arts and Literature publication, because when she took over this position, she looked back at the early issues of The Experience, and she's reading through the first issue in 1968, and she's just blown away by this poem called Inside Out Jesus that refers to the war experience and the, you know, feelings about what's going on in Vietnam at the time. And the poem is by this guy named Frances Poole, and she looks him up and she tracks him down. And it turns out that he's had this incredible career, and he started his published life with The Experience, the very first issue, in 1968, when he was living in Jacksonville and going to what was then Cumberland campus instead of Kent campus. And it was a new college campus fashioned out of old military barracks. So now The Experience is still around, and the release party will be happening next week. And Frances Poole will be back. And there are a couple of events open to the public also. And it's a really kind of exciting full circle sort of experience.
No pun intended.
Right.
Now, you are writing about Poole and all of this at your website, Jack's Psychogeo.
Yeah.
So people can check that out too.
Absolutely. It's been really, just really, really fascinating talking to Frances and finding out what his experience was like here in 1968. He, you know, so he was at then Florida Junior College, and Marilyn DeSimone, her name was Marilyn Gooding at the time, was the faculty advisor of The Experience. He befriended a history professor named Ben Edmondson. He's been friends with him ever since, and Edmondson took him on a tour of Europe. They went across the so-called hippie trails back in the day in the 70s, and that led toward Francis's fascination with Morocco, and he actually lived in Tangier for a number of years and then in Portugal for a few years, and that, of course, also spawned a lot of his poetry and this novel, Ultra Zone, that I should say also is available at Chamlin's and San Marco Bookstore. And we'll be available next week at Kent campus, too.
FSCJ, let's just take a moment to celebrate what a community gem it is. This is just one example of the kinds of offerings FSCJ is giving the community.
I'm so glad you said that, because FSCJ, I just got my years wrong as for when I started teaching there. I started in 2007. The school does so much, and I feel like a lot of what the school does doesn't get celebrated to the extent that it should. And I always try to celebrate it You mentioned the Wilson Center earlier, you know,
yeah, the other night I went to my friend Stacey Goldring, who is our book club leader on the show. Her documentary Traces about second generation Holocaust survivors. It screened at the Wilson Center for the Arts at the FSCJ South Campus, sold out crowd. And as we went in, I was just commenting to my friends, this theater is gorgeous.
Yeah.
And if you've never been to a production there, you should check it out. It's every bit as nice as any other venue in town.
It's incredible. Mm-hmm. FSCJ Drama Works, all of its plays are put on there every term. And I've had the good fortune to have worked with FSCJ Drama Works several times. The art gallery there is wonderful. The experience is this student-led arts and literature publication that's been going on since 1968. I mean, you know, how many colleges can say that? That's a really fantastic thing.
I think that beats Folio Weekly. Maybe not the Florida Times Union, though.
True. Yeah. That's true.
Okay. And so, Tim, you know, as we talk about Francis Poole, let's take a moment to also acknowledge all of your literary output. You're a prolific writer and much beloved in the community. Are you working on something new? My guess is yes, because you always say, yes, I am.
Right. Yeah. Well, so I try to do a story a week on my website, jackpsychogeo.com. I also have, there's a couple of book projects that, I have good solid drafts for. I'll go ahead and say one is about Willie Brown, who, you know, lived without electricity. When he died in 1970, he bequeathed his land to the Nature Conservancy. And that is now the Timequin area of, or the Theodore Roosevelt area of the Timequin Preserve.
The national park.
Yeah.
In our city. Yeah.
Yeah. And he's kind of a local hero. And I've also been working on something, somebody that I talked to you about most recently, which is a totally different kind of character, Warren Foulkes, who was this segregationist character. And I see a lot of the culture war similarities between his extremism and what's happening now. So I feel like it's important to pursue that and to note these kinds of repetitions that happen in our history.
You can check it out at Tim's website, Jack Psycho Geo. And next week, a number of events on the FSCJ Kent campus highlighting their arts and literary community and magazine, The Experience, along with a Q&A with Francis Poole. That's Wednesday, February 8th, 6 p.m. on the Kent campus. Tim Gilmore, thanks.
All right. Thanks so much, Melissa.
When we come back, local favorites love culture, need a little help from you, everybody out there, to be the opening act on a huge global tour with a hip-hop legend. We'll tell you all about it next.
You heard light and graceful repertoire in the last program of the Concert Organ series. Now hear the king of instruments, the Bryan Concert Organ, as it unites with the colossal sounds of brass and percussion for an exhilarating performance on February 11th. Dynamic organist Greg Zelek returns to showcase his mastery that highlights the organ's versatility, musical power, and equally monumental melodies. For tickets, visit jacksymphony.org.
Conservatives in Congress are celebrating the new chairman of the powerful House Judiciary Committee, Jim Jordan of Ohio.
I don't know anybody in town who's better prepared than Jim Jordan to go after the bureaucrats over in the executive branch and to bring light to the weaponization of government against the American people. I think he'll do a great job of it.
I'm Elsa Chang. We'll take a look at the rise of Jim Jordan on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Starting at 4 on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Robin Young. An armed standoff 30 years ago between federal agents and religious fanatics at the Branch Davidian compound in Waco, Texas, led to four dead ATF agents in a fiery disaster that killed over 70 Davidians, including 20 children. The new book, Waco Rising, draws the line from Waco to the January 6th insurrection. Next time, here and now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
India's prime minister has been in power for nearly 9 years, and he's a key player on the world stage. Narendra Modi's supporters say he's made India an economic powerhouse, but his opponents say his policies have oppressed minorities, and he's building an ironclad grip on power. Now he's censoring a documentary in his home country. Narendra Modi and the Future of India, next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
We got growth in abundance, learning more
every
day.
Let's go, let's go.
You can't take it away. We got soap, we got money, but we keep it the faith.
Welcome back. The Jacksonville-based music collective Love Culture has been invited on what is going to be the opportunity of a lifetime for them, the opening act on the first part of a 50-city global tour with a hip-hop legend. But before they take off, they need a little help from their friends in Duval to make it happen. Singer Chi is here now to tell us all about it. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see you.
It's a blessing. Thank you.
So Love Culture is an acronym for League of Vibrant Energies. Tell us about this collective and your music.
Yes. So League of Vibrant Energies is a spinoff of the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, which was crafted by the co-founder, Rob Mari. He's a part of the group. So it's me. Singer, lyricist, Chi. Rob Mari, he's a lyricist as well as a the business extraordinaire, spirit art in-house engineer, as well as a singer, songwriter. Easy and 2D and Flash the Samurai, both amazing lyricists and writers as well. We've been together for about 5-6 years now and taking the city and all of Florida by storm, and now we're just ready to take on the world. So.
Okay, so you have been invited to be the opening act on the first leg of a 50-city global tour kicking off at the end of February with a legendary headliner.
Yes, yes.
Which you can't reveal just
no,
yet.
I can't.
But you're, what we're hearing is this is a hip-hop legend.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
So in order to do this, you need to raise a little money. Can you explain why?
Yeah, absolutely. So the power of our fans have been able to allow us access to really great opportunities over the years. And all of our fans know we talk about this all the time. Being an independent artist, it just comes with a lot. You know, you have to fund yourself. You have to fund your music. You have to fund all of the things to be able to, like, be successful. And a tour is no different. There are things that cost things that we have to cover. And when we were trying to figure out what's the best way to go about this, we were like, let's just ask the people. Let's see. There are plenty of people that always ask, you know, like, how can we help? How we can support? And we were like, let's just put it out there. And it's been very successful so far.
Yeah, I'm looking at your page at Indiegogo.
Yeah.
You are trying to raise a little over $8,000.
Yep.
You're almost halfway there.
Yep.
And this is to cover stuff like hotels, transportation, gas, merchandise, videographer.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is you're going to raise a little money and then go and tour Atlanta, Greenville, Spruce Pine, Asheville, and Charlotte. So all over the Southeast.
Yes.
With a hip hop legend.
Yes. Yes.
You must be pretty excited.
I am super excited. We all are. And honestly, like, every donation we've gotten so far, we're so thankful for. You know, we're hitting the ground and we're really excited to show the world what Jacksonville can do. We feel like we're a great representation of that. And we're going to make y'all proud for sure.
All right. So you won't tell me who this hip hop legend is, even though we've all tried to ask, like, who are we talking about?
Yeah.
Like, you know, I'm just going to throw out random names. I don't know. Jay-Z, N.W.A.
You're not going to get it out of me, Melissa.
The Fugees, like Lauryn Hill, P. Diddy. I don't know. Like who?
Mum's the word. But y'all will find out very, very soon.
Nas.
Yeah.
DMX.
All rest in peace, DMX, I would hope.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. Sorry.
Yeah.
Okay. So look, this is what you got to do, everybody. Indiegogo.com. Contribute what you can to Love Culture.
Yes.
It's their super big move of the year.
Yes.
They're trying to raise $8,100. They're at $3,700, yep. So they're about halfway there.
Yep, we've got 27 days left.
They've got to have a little help from Duval to get them on tour.
Yes.
And this is their big break, right? This is your big break.
Yeah, we've been doing this 5 years, and it feels that way. And what's really great, too, is if you donate, it comes with perks. So it's not just you donate and it goes away. We have some really, really great perks that we have for people that are going to donate. You can donate as low as 25, as high as you want to go. And right now, we did receive an anonymous $1,500 donation.
Nice.
But the catch is we have to match the dollar. So for every dollar that's donated, that person's going to match it. And together, we can raise like $3,000. And that would really put us toward our goals. So.
And what perks do they get special access to you?
Yeah. So everything from just a postcard from the road to... the biggest one is just like doing VIP access for a big show that we've got going on this year. Mm-hmm. All the details are in the Indiegogo, but we're not leaving you empty-handed. We want to show the people that donate that we love them, and we're very, very grateful, and we want to take y'all with us. So
check it out. Donate what you can. Help local favorites love culture.
Yes.
Get to their big break. Go to Indiegogo.com. Just search Love Culture and check it out. A little more of their music. Chi, thank you so much and good luck.
Thank you, Melissa.
We'll be back tomorrow at 9 a.m. Have a great day.
Now it's funny that you all in my face. We got growth in abundance, learning more every day. We got growth in abundance,
floating higher than my price line. Perfect picture, Mona Lisa with the nice vibes. Pull up with the hello, nice to meet you. It's the right time. Pretty melanated, going flexing. Blessings to you, baby. Steady working, power in my spirit. I do what I do and do it well. Haters like to see me living, but would never tell.
Let's go, let's go, let's go.
The law before my daughter came from hell.
Let's go, let's go, let's go.
Wasn't well, but that'll never fail.
See, we had to make a way to get it, and we had some major pain. Attention, it wasn't much paid. It raised suspicion. Now we can't change the lane. These lyrics is really insane. No way educating. I'm really amazed. We making a difference. Nothing they say can ever get near us. Living your dreams, we feeling the spirit. Living your dreams.
Yeah. So we got money, but we keeping the faith. See, it's up. Now it's funny that you all in my face. We got growth in abundance, learning more every day.
What?
Hey. We can't take it away. We got soul, we got money, but we keeping the faith. See us up, now it's funny that you all in my face. We got growth in abundance, learning more every day. We got growth in abundance,
and it won't be the same.
Hey,
yeah.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.